Everyone's talking about the score, right? You know, you got your John Williams coming back, recording. It's different. It's a different orchestra. It's a different sound. It's a more subtle, dynamic score. It's not quite as bombastic. All kinds of stuff to talk about and parse. But I want to talk about the piccolo guy. You know what I'm talking about. Dude what sits in the center of the orchestra and gets so excited about the Star Wars main theme. I challenge you, go listen right now to the opening bombastic main theme on track one of the Force Awakens soundtrack, and you're going to hear that piccolo dude just laying into it. Like, the entire rest of the orchestra could stop, and he would just still be sitting there in the middle, awkwardly belting out, let's hit it. On this episode of the Star Wars Report podcast, we are reviewing in depth The Force Awakens. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. We've got a lot to say about this film. Had a lot of time to see it and see it again. And we're here to parse what we liked, what we didn't like, and really process this like we all are as Star Wars fans.
Falcon flight with destiny.
That's right, folks. Here it is. The Star Wars Report returns post-Christmas. And we're talking about The Force Awakens. Folks, this is a film that, if you listen to the last episode, has taken a whole lot to process. And we're here. We've had a little bit more time to think, like I said. So we're going to have a good time really breaking it down. I'd like to bring in to the program my sister. It's Bethany Blanton, everybody. How's it going, Bethany?
Hello, everyone. It's going well.
Well done. Look at that timing. Perfect. Well done. That was, I'm impressed. That's exactly how it said. And speaking of excellent timing, I want to bring him in as well. I don't want to waste any time bringing in my co-host, your good friend and mine. It's Mr. Mark Herleman, everybody.
Hey, is it Star Wars Report time? I think it's time to talk some Star Wars. You've all came to the right place. Glad to have you here.
Mm-hmm. Come on in. Come on in. Listen to the funky music in the background and ignore the peg leg pirates and this Maz Kanata din of iniquity.
Or pay attention to all the pirates in the background. Just lose yourself looking for the dark black stormtrooper with the gold X.
And wonder why there aren't any familiar Star Wars aliens and why they're all brand new. And then realizing, oh, they should all be brand new because the Star Wars universe isn't small and it's expansive and it's growing.
It's
so stop
diverse.
Complaining, Riley. Come on. No, folks, we are here. We've got, man, so much to talk about. So much to talk about. And we're going to really get into the film in depth. But before we do that, we've actually taken some time off here from actually talking about the cultural phenomenon that is The Force Awakens. Like, this thing, it's blowing up in a big way. So without further ado, I say it's time we get straight into the news.
We have something to report.
Come closer, I have good news.
The data brought to us by the Bothan spies.
We can send a clear transmission.
There it is. Listen.
That's right, folks. You want to guess what's burning up the box office? It's the
Alvin and the Chipmunks.
Alvin and the Chipmunks 3. Yeah,
stood a chance.
No, I'm just kidding. It's sisters.
No, it's sisters. That girl power.
Or we've got what is it? The Hateful Eight. Actually, I kind of do want to go see the Hateful Eight.
I want to go see that too, but we're waiting until January here. Is this Star Wars month?
I know, man. I know. I'm super excited. No, it's the Force Awakens. What's funny is that I put up a story just the other day. As I was preparing for this week's show, and it's from Forbes, and it's Star Wars The Force Awakens box office sets all kinds of Christmas records. In fact, it was $27 million for Christmas Eve this past Thursday. A record, all-time record for Christmas. And, of course, this is a week after its opening weekend. So barely any drop. This thing is burning up the box office charts. What's funny is I don't even have it in front of me, but not but an hour ago, I saw a Hollywood Reporter piece that had the numbers from Christmas Day, and it was $49 million. Another huge, huge, huge box office achievement for Christmas Day. Folks, this brings the total of this film. It's already, within 12 days of being released, crossed the finish line of $1 billion international. $1 billion. One quarter of the entire price of Lucasfilm was made in 12 days at the box office. I think Bob Iger's sitting somewhere very excited about this.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's funny that there's so many people that are like, well, I'm not going to go the first week. I'm going to wait. And I'm just like, you guys realize that there is every bit as many of you doing that as there are people that are got to be in the seat the first day. It's not going to be any less busy for you because there are so many of you with that same idea. And unfortunately, coupled with that are people like me who was there on the first day, who was there on the second day, you know, was there on the next day and is waiting to go and watch it on his third time, fourth time, you know, watching it weeks later. I mean, people are watching this over and over again. So you people that are waiting 1 or 2 weeks to watch it, you know, and are mad because everyone's spoiling it for you. It's like, get to the theater. Quit waiting. Everybody is going. Everybody is waiting. It's going to be busy all the way until January. I wouldn't be surprised if this movie's still going to be busy in February.
Yeah, no, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's one of those things that it's just absolutely incredible how much this film has really captured the hearts and minds of the entire culture. And it bears mentioning that this, you know, these numbers come without the China box office, which is huge. So, like, Star Wars is beating up the previous record holder from earlier this year, Jurassic World. And that was released in China the same day. So there, it's kind of, when you just look at and crunch the numbers in the Super Bowl numbers game of box office receipts, Star Wars is winning everything. Like,
speaking of crunching, that reminds me of that great internet meme where the guy from Jurassic World come up and was telling Lucas that he was still number one, and Lucas like, Star Wars is gonna it's gonna crush you like a bug.
you'll be destroyed.
Well, yeah, the fact that China is completely out of that, like,
we're stomping on the graves of the dinosaurs.
Hanging moment there. I mean, because that's some big numbers. I mean, China, like, you know, that's where everybody's at is China. They got like the world's population, like, all in their borders.
I know. Like, this is, I didn't actually have the updated piece in front of me because that's how quickly it's like every day it's still setting all kinds of records.
Well, and it reminds me of a friend of ours who messaged and was like, if you guys can stop seeing Star Wars, that I can actually get a ticket for a time that I want, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, because
said jokingly, but
we still had to pre-purchase tickets. We still can't go to the box office and get good seats. You still have to order and reserve ahead of time if you want any kind of decent
or else get there
seats
definitely early.
See, that's interesting because my town, you know, we're small, you know, I'd say our end of the state is probably smaller than where you guys are living when it comes to population of people, but we're having an opposite of that. Like, you can still go down and get your tickets for that day's showings, but good luck finding anywhere to park. the parking lot has been slammed every day since that movie's came out. And I know this because I literally just got hired on at the local theater. And I was going down there every day checking on my resume. And I would literally have to park three blocks over and walk because the parking lot was full every single day. But yeah.
I love that you're dropping awesome. That's awesome, man. That's I love that you dropped that on air. That's really cool. Congrats.
thank you.
It's funny is that friend of the show and co-host on Star Wars Tonight, Justin Robert Young, tweeted out a picture on a Tuesday morning screening in the middle of the week, in the morning, when the fewest people ever go to the movie. He was trying to just go see it again, and there was still a giant line about 30 minutes early. And that was true for us. We went and saw it last night, and I guess this is as good a time as any. I'm going to bring in some more stories just as it comes up in conversation. But we'll kind of transition into our review here. Last night, me and Bethany and my mom had to find a screening that still had seats. So we had to go all the way to 10:30 at night. Yeah. All the other regular kind of matinee, afternoon, and early evening showings didn't have any good seats left. And we wanted to go up to the Regal Atlantic Station because it has what they call the Regal RPX, the Regal Premium Experience. Trademark 2015. But we wanted to go see it in Dolby Atmos surround sound. I mean, it's a nice screen. It's almost as big as an IMAX screen, not quite. But their big selling point is a really high quality digital projection. And more importantly, Dolby Atmos. It's like 14 or 15 point surround sound speakers that are just really bombastically loud. It is awesome. It was by far the best quality presentation of the film that we had seen thus far. And we've seen it in regular 2D, regular 3D, like real D 3D, and then, of course, IMAX 3D. But now, and then our fourth screening, which is funny because, like, wow, that's a lot. That's a lot, man. And then I realized, like, William Devereaux. friend of the show, William Devereaux, has seen it 9 times now. It is insane. It's a lot for me, though. I think I've got probably at least 2 or 3 more screenings in me. And I know, like, for a lot of fans, it's a tradition of seeing it, like, 24 times in theaters. I don't think that's really what... I don't know that I want to see it that many times. I don't know that I want to be that familiar with it until it's available. Available now on Blu-ray.
Well, let me raise the ponder for you. I saw an internet meme yesterday that was asking the question, how many times have you seen The Force Awakens in the cinema? And I'm like, how sad is that we're not even 2 weeks, we're not even 10 days after at this point. It wasn't even 10 days after the film came out, and they have to specify in cinema because it's already streaming on pirate sites. Like, within 10 days? Like,
oh, yeah.
It just makes me want to do the facepalm, but I've heard so many great things about seeing it in IMAX, seeing it in the different 3Ds. I haven't got to see it in 3D yet. I'm really looking forward to it. I know that the first Star Destroyer scene in 3D is just supposedly
a lot
spectacular.
Better.
I mean, like, it's a great scene in 2D, but I've heard, like, it just sits in front of you and just mesmerizes the hell out of you, which in 2D, it's a really great shot, but it's so dark that you don't really tell. And I've heard that in the 3D, what was dark now is like, bam, right in front of you. And you're like, oh my God.
Yes.
And so I'm really looking forward to that. I'm very thankful that I've done it this route, you know, like I've got something still that's new to see when I watch the movie, because I haven't seen it with those effects yet.
Oh, absolutely.
So I'm like really stoked like that. But the downside for me is this, and I know you guys are going to feel me on this. This is a story that hurts my heart. I'm going to go and see 3D with my dad. Right. But the fool has already started reading the website's reviews of the movie from fans of Legends, from fans of the original trilogy, for fans of the prequel trilogy. But he's reading all the ones where people are pissed. And I'm like, dude, why are you reading these? It's infecting the way you're going to go into the movie. Like, he was already mad that none of it counts. I'm like, what do you mean? You knew it wasn't counting. You knew this wasn't Legends. I've told you this for months. Oh, he's so twisted about it. I'm like, I think I've lost him.
Is he reading spoilers?
I am terrified I'm losing him for this.
Now, here's the thing, though. Is he reading spoilers?
He knows. He knows all about the big stuff, man.
Mark,
he knows who dies. He knows who does what. And I'm just like, why? Why would you do this? You knew this movie was really important. Why would you do that? And then the way he found out was all those spin sites. So of course, you know, they're taking things completely out of context. The unforgivable sins. I'm like, and I was reading them. I'm like, half of those, there was explanations in the film.
Oh yeah. There are a lot of those. Like, I saw Pablo Hidalgo tweet. He's been tweeting a lot of really funny stuff about this, but it's sort of like, he's just started tweeting out classic beloved films and plot holes in them. So he's like, where did the piano come from in Casablanca? It just showed up in the middle of the scene. Plot hole. a lot of the things that I thought were plot holes in the film that I really didn't get on the first viewing were really just, I think, a matter of the editing. It's
like race power.
It's obvious upon repeated viewings that this is a heavily trimmed film. Like, they were cut into the bone, I think, to keep this close to 2 hours. I think just from, you know, all the shots in the trailers that weren't in the film and all other things, I think that we're really getting the sense that this film was trimmed, in my view, too much. I would have rather had like 2 hours, 20 minutes closer to the Revenge of the Sith runtime than try to, I think, the extra 5 to 10 minutes of footage, I think, contains a lot of explanation on things.
Well, that and people are confusing plot holes with explanations. You don't have to have every single thing in a movie explained to make sense.
Like, I really did
not. You can be left with questions about the plot, and that does not make it a plot
hole. Well, and the way the editing works is that when you first see Starkiller Base operational, fully armed and operational, when it destroys the Hosnian system halfway through the film. Oh, by the way, I think this just bears saying, just since we haven't gotten spoilers yet.
Spoilers.
There will be spoilers. So here's your chance.
Spoilers.
Bail now. But like when the Empire, Empire, I keep doing that.
Good grief.
When they destroy the Hosnian system with Starkiller Base, they don't really show you it sucking up the energy from the sun. When it's first introduced, you don't really understand how the weapon works until the towards the end of the film. When I first watched it, I was so like in sensory overload. I'm an idiot, and I just missed whole swaths of plot and explanation and like many things that I'm like, how on earth did I miss that? But like, I missed largely, like, I didn't make all of the appropriate connections in my mind on first viewing of how Starkiller Base worked or why. Like the poetry of, you know, as long as there's light, there's hope. That line.
That was a great scene, man.
Yeah, and it alludes very well to, you know, the following scene where the light goes out, you know, as the confrontation between Han Solo and, you know, and Kylo Ren.
The visual dictionary names a lot of things. Like, I believe that's the one that mentions that they had drained the sun of another system before they moved where they were in the film. So they already had a full tank, so to speak, and
sure,
that sun hadn't been tapped on. But one of the scenes that my dad had brought up, and he was going off about how, oh, you know, this is unforgivable, was how Han found the Falcon right away. And I'm like, I told him, I said, well, even the guy writing the article clearly missed later in the movie when they show up at Maz's. Han tells Rey they can't take the Falcon. They need a clean ship. And he says, how do you think Han and Chewie found the ship so fast? It was being tracked. Why do you think Uthar was keeping it parked on Jakku? He didn't want Han to find it. There was a tracking thing on it. He didn't have it disabled. So, you know, it was basically putting out like, you know, a trail for a sense, or for lack of better purpose. But
Tales
it came so much later that it's like, man, if you weren't paying attention later on in the movie, that little bit of explanation was, it'd slip right past you.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it did the first viewing. I totally missed that. Like, I read, and I was kind of colored by some of those quote-unquote think pieces early on that were pointing out quote-unquote plot holes, where it's like, yeah, why on earth did they go to Maz Kanata's at all when they already had BB-8? Why didn't they just fly straight to the Rebellion? I'm like, yeah, why didn't they fly straight to the Rebellion? I'm a blogger, and I'm smarter than J.J. Abrams and Lawrence Kasdan, who wrote The Empire Strikes Back, arguably the best film ever made.
Yeah, and then that.
And then upon repeated views, I'm like, oh, yeah, because the Millennium Falcon can be easily tracked and they need to find another ship.
Well, and even secondarily, they explain that Han is avoiding going back to the Resistance because he does not want to get back involved. He doesn't want to face Leia in light of what happened to their son. So he, at this point, would use any excuse he could to not go straight back to the Resistance.
Yeah. And so
another one was, how did the Rathars get around? Why was Han just keeping the Rathars loose in the ship? And why didn't they eat him before? And I was like,
and they're like, they're locked.
That they were locked away.
But yeah. I think
you're
largely,
like, well, we know where you went to the bathroom in the middle of the movie, right there when Rey and Finn were underneath.
I do want to say this, though. I think that is really not the consensus. That's really something that I think the blogosphere, the fact that they're talking about minute details of like the political environment or the structural from point A to point B criticisms of what people assume rightfully or wrongfully so are plot holes. Like, that tells you how great this movie is, because we're not complaining about the dialogue or characterizations or characters or villains, or like, I don't hear anyone saying that, man, you know, that Han death scene was really just, spoiler alert, I'm sure anyone who's listening to this now has figured out. I'm still kind of paranoid.
We gave a spoiler warning in the beginning of the show, and we'll put one in the show notes as well, and I put one in the live chat.
There we go.
So we should be
appreciated.
Covered. I mean, you would.
Sorry, what was I saying, though? I totally lost my train of thought.
I love you, son.
Yes, yes. And like even in that confrontation, you don't hear anybody saying, well, you know, that was really just poorly executed on Harrison Ford's part. No. It's why? Because it's brilliantly done. Right.
Well, the thing that gets me is a lot of these complaints are like, well, you have to read the book or you have to do this. It's like it just jumped right in. Like we didn't know why there was a resistance and the Republic and the First Order. And it's like, that's a classic Lucas thing. What did we get with the New Hope? We were jumped right in the middle of the story. We had to figure out things as we went along. How did the Empire get there? We didn't know. There was a lot of mystery that didn't get solved till much later on.
I want to point out, how did C-3PO end up in the Jawa Sandcrawler? Plot hole. No, I don't want to get trapped too much because I don't even really think like a lot of these pieces. I don't even want to give the time of day, to be honest. It's because there are the legitimate criticisms, and we'll get into them in the show here. The legitimate criticisms, I think, come at the editing level and the execution level. There are a few small quibbles I have, but when it comes to like the structure and maybe not structure because that kind of is editing, but when it comes to the story overall, I have very, very few complaints.
Gentleman's quibble. Okay. I was looking at the visual guide and it was talking and it explained something great about, you know, well, Rey comes from a desert planet. So she was ill prepared for when they got to Starkiller Base and it was really cold. And I'm sitting there and I'm looking and I'm thinking, you know what? The gentlemanly thing to do, Han Solo, is to take that winter jacket off and give it to the girl that's been living on a freaking hot planet all this time. Hey, Finn, you got an extra jacket too. Like, really, guys? You're going
to
make the girl wear
it? They did give it to her.
She's dressed for the beach.
Did you see the shot of Rey wearing Finn's jacket?
She was wearing Finn's jacket.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a nice touch.
I missed that.
No, you'll see it. It's very brief in one of the shots. It's not in the first one, but when they head back outside to climb up the exterior.
Awesome.
Finn gives her the jacket, which
I was looking at that visual guide and I laughed about that, but like they had tongue in cheek and explained it. I was like, well, she was ill prepared and was just like, yeah, let's go. And they got out there and was like, oh, it's kind of cold out here.
I know exactly. But I feel like we've almost, there's already a kind of level of conversation that we're in and that the community's in that we haven't taken the time, I think, to even process this movie to the level of really getting it into the minutia too much. I just want to start like saying, for me, like if you want the broad, because last week's episode was sort of like a wake / funeral. It was sort of like us all just mourning the loss. And I think it was tonally appropriate because I think that's how a lot of people left theaters feeling. And I was glad we kind of captured that raw emotion. I thought last week's episode was great, but I can understand we in some of the feedback we did get, you know, very legitimately mournful because it is a tragedy that we lost Han Solo, and we're going to get into that a little bit later. But I just want to say, like, this movie overall, in my view, J.J. Abrams took the best elements of the original trilogy and he didn't remake any of these movies. He remixed them in a deftly amazing, if slightly safe, this is like my view, if slightly safe structure, with one, of course, notable exception, and that being the death of Han Solo. Narratively speaking, I think this film is very much a remix of a lot of what made the original trilogy great. And I really like that. I also think some of the film's weaknesses come from that view and that approach that I think J.J. Abrams had, but I think they're very small in comparison to the thrill ride that they had. And so while yes, it's kind of another Death Star, and yes, structurally it doesn't resolve in the same way A New Hope does, with like the central hero at the central moment destroying the central threat from the central villain, it's not all like in that neatly wrapped up way.
Central,
but that's because it's
central.
Kind of a wrapping up and a mixture of the original trilogy, and I think it works great. So like if you're asking Riley what he thinks of the film, I loved it, and that's we're really going to get into it. But now that we've actually had some time to process it, Bethany, your overall thoughts now, where we stand, four viewings in, we've had some time to process it, where are you sitting on this?
Oh wow. So for my first viewing, I did come out of the theater a little bit dazed. I think that I was reeling from Star Wars overload, if you will. And so much of it was completely unfamiliar because I managed to stay pretty spoiler free for the most part. But at the same time, so much of it was very familiar. You know, specific shots that reminded me a whole lot of the original trilogy. And I found that a little bit distracting, but upon further viewings, upon four of them at this point, the film has continually grown upon me in each viewing. And that's not to say that I didn't like it the first viewing. I loved it the first viewing.
And that's a very broad sentiment,
too. And I came out of it.
Why do you think that is? Not to interject too much, but delve into that a little bit. Yeah, why do you think? Because this has been the sentiment from a lot of folks.
Well, in part because, I'll put it this way, and Darth Hound is in the chat right now. He said that he knew most of the spoilers going into the movie, or at least prior to the movie, he said that he was looking at all of the spoilers and enjoying putting the pieces together. And also that he read some of the novelizations of previous Star Wars movies before going and seeing the actual movie, and that he enjoyed them still just as much, if not more. And I was thinking about it. For every single other Star Wars movie that I saw, I already knew all of the major spoilers going in.
Yeah.
I had already had the music memorized, like listened to it over and over and over and over and over again for years before I saw the actual films, before I even knew that the music was from Star Wars, because my sister would play the soundtracks.
Yeah, no, we've talked about it. That's such a central part.
And so, in some ways, the themes were so familiar to me. There is no shock. There is no confusion. There are no missed plot moments because you're paying attention to something else or thinking about some other part of the movie. Like, Riley, you completely missed that Starkiller Base was sucking in stars.
And it's very obvious in the
literally
film.
Literally killing stars in order to fuel itself.
Like if the name fits.
And I teased you pretty mercilessly about that once you figured it out. So I think once there's a familiarity with the story, in some ways you can enjoy it almost more so. Because I left the theater loving the film, but I was dazed. I was shocked by the death of Han Solo. Not that I didn't think it would happen once he pursued his son on the bridge, but it was such a... You aren't able to fully take it in on the first viewing. And I'll liken it again to The Lord of the Rings, you know, where I had read the book numerous times before I saw the films, and the films still moved me tremendously. Yeah. And I was actually thinking when you started the podcast today that the most times that I've ever cried in any films were The Lord of the Rings. I have shed tears during multiple viewings of those. And episode 7. They are the two movies where I have shed tears after more than one viewing. There have been other movies where I get teary-eyed or sniffly or shed a few tears during the first viewing, but I've never had a movie with a repeat viewing outside of Lord of the Rings and The Return of the Jedi and episode 7. But with Return of the Jedi, it was only two viewings, and it was Yoda's death.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think, and that's such a good point because it's so hard to get past the weight of expectations, even if they're not necessarily overhyped. I don't feel like I was overhyped for this movie, but just like there's sort of especially as much as doing podcasting and blogging, I think totally I underestimated the weight of expectations and like, what if I don't like it? Or this is strange, or I'm not used to this. It's different. You guys remember, like for me and Bethany, watching a brand new Star Wars film in theaters is something we have never done. Ever. Like, let me say that again. Watching a brand new Star Wars film in theaters is something that Bethany and I have never experienced. So it was odd. And I think like you reacted more positively first viewing than I did, because I was really still trying to process it so much. But Mark, where's your head now that we've had some time to look at it? You've been in theaters twice. And I'll tell you what, like, did you cry? Did it move you?
So first, it's crazy just to think that you guys missed episode 3. I mean, yeah. I did go to see that one. I had already had what me and Nathan called the Stover effect, where his book was so good and it brought so many of the scenes that had fallen to the floor. You know, the Delegation of 2000, everything out of me, pretty much had fallen off the film. That really helped. So I was kind of, I was worried going in because we weren't having that. I wasn't going to get to hear the audiobook until the day after my first viewing. So I was going to be completely blank slated. So I was kind of in the same boat as Bethany, stayed away from most of the spoilers aside from the stuff we talked about the show possibilities of, and I never went out of my way to have it confirmed or anything like that. So I knew there was a possibility Han might die or Chewie might die or Finn might die. I was kind of going around the glimpse of Rey when it later turned out to be Finn in the forest, but I thought that might have been Han or Chewie. I kind of had that thought, this could happen. I was hoping it wouldn't kind of happen because, as I said in our last episode, Han's my guy when it comes to canon. But when I watched it the first time, I was more in that moment of still processing that scene. I'll say flat out, I came away absolutely loving the film. Everything about it, I really got a kick out of it. I wasn't expecting it to be, the EU point two. I was expecting some nods here or there, cause they were a shared universe for so long. Having the moment when Han calls out to his son, just finding out that Han and Leia had a son, I was tickled immediately because they always had a son. They had two, but they always had one son that I was always kind of like, yay, Han's got a little boy. So I was excited for that. And then when he yelled out Ben, there was a mixed grief moment for me there. I was excited in the fact that, the name Ben crossed over and people could say coincidental because you could also say that it was named after Ben Kenobi.
Yeah, that's kind of my view.
That Leia really had no connection to Ben Kenobi like Luke did. When Luke naming his son Ben made more sense than Leia naming her son Ben. But I was excited because I named one of my sons, the one that we lost, Ben. So I was like, hey, Ben's got a canon name too.
Yeah.
So I'm coming up from it like that, where I'm still processing, hey, Rey's got a mom out there. Let her be Jaina Jade. I'll be excited for that because I've got a daughter, Taylor Jade, and a daughter named Jaina. I just want the names to cross over at this point. But when the name Ben came over in that regard and it crossed over, my heart ached though, because I was like, here's the name of one of the kids from, the name was always a grandson of Vader. So that aspect came across. So I was like, oh no, and Jason fell to the dark side and Jason fired on the Falcon and almost killed his parents a couple times. There was all that stuff that was there with me and having that moment go through, and I really talk about this a lot in our last episode with my relation with Han, but it was that second viewing that I started picking up on more things. I always said from the beginning, it had all the right trappings, but when I noticed that scene, right when Han walks out and he calls Ben and everything, that became my favorite moment in the film on my second viewing. My favorite scene is still the one where Finn's out there in the middle of the battle and Poe's flying around and you see Poe in the background, Finn's centered. That was a great filming, good choice on JJ all around.
Amazing shot.
But on the second viewing, when I'm watching that scene where Han yells out to Ben and they're out there and he closes the distance, they're highlighted by the light streaking in, Finn and Rey, they come through that top opening and it allows the last dying light of the planets or the sun to come in. And while they're talking, and Ben's talking about being scared and needing the strength to do what he needs to do. I mean, it was just such a powerful moment. And as the last of that sun disappeared, that was when the last of the light inside Ben died with it in that moment. And granted, he may regret that moment, but it was that moment frozen in time as you watched that sliver of light just shimmer out in non-existence. And you had that great view of the whole cavernous room. I think even Chewie was in the bottom corner. It was just a great, powerful moment that on the second viewing, I was just completely blown away. And that was when the tears started. I couldn't stop it. The first time through, I was just processing everything. And I just it tore me up. My heart was aching, but I was just in so much shock. I could not shed a tear. But that second time, that moment just it tore through me. And then Chewie running and Chewie never missed. If you watch, Chewie never missed. And I my heart broke all over again for that. And that's the part that just tears me up. I said in our last episode, my favorite stuff is the stuff where my favorite heroes end up dying. I hate it when it happens. But in hindsight, they are my favorite stories. And that has definitely got it going on for this film for me. You know, yeah, I was pointing out the little thing about, you know, Ray being out there and stuff, and there's little minutia like that. But again, I point out every film, every book, every game, every comic that has a Star Wars logo has got those same ups, those same downs, those same plot holes, that same, whoops, I forgot about this. I forgot about that. That's the nature of the publishing game, the industry of what they're creating. They're creating an IP, and, you know, you've got people not in on all the conferences. I mean, it's just the nature of the game. And I can't fault something that I love this much with as many other people that are creating it, passionate about fixing any kind of flaws like that. You know, I mean, I said from the start, I don't want to see retcons, but hey, at the same time, as an EU fan, some of the best story opportunities come out of retcons when they find a way to fix what was a small little plot hole because they had to cut something out. You know, like the whole Maz handing over the lightsaber to Leia. That doesn't exist right now in canon, even though we saw it on the trailer. But yeah, I mean, I'm still in that processing. I'm still processing the things about it that I love the most. The things about it that I dislike. I'm hesitant to even use the word hate because there's nothing about this film that I hated.
Yeah.
You know, even like I would say, like, the closest I could get to hating is like, I didn't like the choice of Adam Driver as a Solo child because I don't think he looks like him, but I think that Adam Driver did a great job of making me conflicted with the character because I want to hate him for what he's done. But at the same time, the end of the day, this is Ben Solo. This is Han and Leia's kid. And in my heart of hearts, I don't want to see him condemned for this action because he's the grandson of Anakin Skywalker. He's Leia's boy.
I'm very much.
And there's so much good and bad that I'm just like so conflicted. I'm still absorbing it all. I can't wait for my next viewing to get more. I did see KT, the R2 unit, and that was exciting. But yeah, I mean, there's just so much stuff going on in the background that if you're not paying attention, you're not going to see it.
Exactly. And I'm still very conflicted about the whole Kylo Ren thing, because when I first saw it, I'm like, all right, let the try to think of a way to words are coming to my mind to describe Kylo Ren that are less than nice. So
that snake in the grass.
Yes, thank you. The little weasel, the little worm, I just like wanted him to like, all right, it's time, he's irredeemable. But if we're speaking like the large, in the poetic terms of Star Wars, the first act of each trilogy has the mentor figure die, who is killed by a villain. And in the original trilogy, that villain is Darth Vader, and he's redeemed. So it would be very tough, a big challenge to set about the redemption of Kylo Ren. I'd be open to it, but it's hard to even consider. And the whole thing about that death scene that I want to point out is that it's, And I kind of took a little bit of a swing at this film for being a little bit narratively predictable in the realm of Star Wars, not necessarily being the worst thing in the world, but when it comes to the structure of the film, there's a lot that parallels with the various original trilogy films, whether it's coming to a strange planet and meeting a thousand-year-old alien that is wise, that is able to give you wisdom on how to move forward, and then you suddenly crash into the lower levels of some eerie place and receive a force vision, right? Like, you have very close parallels with Empire Strikes Back, or whether it's the first act of the film or the third act. And I won't get into all the details there, but suffice to say, the one thing of this movie that has guts, a lot of guts, is killing off Han Solo, because it was done really well. Mm-hmm. And even though narratively it follows very much along the same lines as Ben, the first time you see Star Wars, it's a tragedy, but you're not killing off an icon of cinema. And the easy move for Disney and company to be would be like, all right, Harrison Ford, we got a couple hundo millions to keep you in for this whole trilogy, and we're going to keep Han Solo, you know, the smuggler everyone loves from Star Wars, Han Solo, we're not gonna keep him around. In fact, we're gonna kill him off. And that, I think, is a gutsy move that I liked, because and I feel like here there's a piece actually from Vanity Fair that I actually have here, and it's pretty interesting. It's basically, did they have to kill Han Solo? Like, really? And J.J. Abrams actually had something to say about it. right here in this piece. It's over the weekend, J.J. Abrams justified what has to be one of the most painful deaths in movie and maybe storytelling history, and that if they didn't do it, quote, The Force Awakens wouldn't have any guts. And diehard fans do know, and as we do know, Harrison Ford has wanted Han Solo to bite the proverbial dust since Return of the Jedi. That's something that even in the behind the scenes that Lawrence Kasdan wanted. So it's not necessarily a big surprise there. But still, as the writer puts it in the thing, he said, quote, I can't take my mother to see this movie. She might stab J.J. Abrams through the heart with a lightsaber. Because, you know, his mom introduced him to these films, and a big part of what she loved about the original trilogy was Han Solo. And it's not just killing a beloved character. In the way the writer here at Vanity Fair is John Lopez, he says it's killing the beloved character. And it's hard to imagine a universe, a Star Wars universe, without Han Solo. And it's hard to imagine a universe where Han Solo and Luke Skywalker and Princess Leia, the big three, will never be reunited sitting in the seat behind, in the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon. We're never going to see that. And that, to me, it was the, especially having had time to reflect on it a lot more, is what I've really, really loved about the guts that it takes to do something like that and to pull it off.
Well, one thing that I think of is, you know, we've heard Kathleen Kennedy mention that all the cast is returning. We talked about, you know, well, what does that mean for Han? But I was thinking too, you know, what if we get flashback to the Jedi Order's fall at Ben's hands? I mean, the one thing that really threw me off the most about this new direction for canon was that Ben's actions wiping out the last of Luke's order, possibly Luke's wife, maybe, we don't even know at this point. But what Ben does at that moment is so bad that it drives both Han and Luke away. And, you know, I keep thinking, you know, we're probably not going to get that in a book because they're going to save that for episode 8.
Yeah.
But what if they tell it to us in a flashback? What if we do get to see Han still in the film, but he's, you know, doing the flashback? I mean, and again, I mean, I think that's going to be a gut check moment because you're still reeling with the fact that he's not there. You know, he's died. And I think a Grey's Anatomy, when they killed off Mark Sloan, you know, there was a death that they drug out for three different episodes and you thought he died three different ways before they finally offed the character. And you're just like, oh my God, that was brutal. But what if they do something like that where, you know, Han's dead. Now you're watching, you know, the moment that drove him away and you're just like, oh, this is what you were never going to see him again. Until they're at the resistance base.
If I may say, Darth Hound has read the entire novelization for The Force Awakens, and the novel does reveal that Snoke has been working on turning Ben to the dark side essentially since Ben's birth.
And Leia knew too.
Yeah, Leia knows it. I don't know if Han necessarily accepted it, but
there's a lot to there with what Leia knew and what she didn't tell Han from that book that just it brought the hairs on the back of my neck up during that scene when she says, bring our boy home. Cause when I was watching it on my second time, I turned to my wife and I go, she just got him killed. And my wife's like, what? And I'm like, that's what got him killed. Leia saying that. If Leia hadn't said that, Han probably would have turned his back, but it was Leia. It was the one person above all the rest that he would do anything for.
But bring admittedly, home my son. Han would have turned his back, not because he didn't love his son, but because he had no faith in his own ability to help his son.
Which was obvious in the movie when he's like, Luke's a Jedi. If he couldn't help him, how could I? Mm-hmm. And she's like, you're his
but,
father.
But in the book, it says, or it says that Han has not seen Ben's face since Ben was a child. And
that's
this
true.
Is the first time that Han sees Ben's
face of my son
since as a grown man, which makes that line even more heartbreaking. The face of my son, but
even just thinking about it now, as much as we devoted almost the entire episode last week to it, our conversation has naturally turned here because it is such a powerful and well done moment that defines this movie.
It does, but also at the same time, this movie it really takes a step forward because I think we all are becoming attached to, if not already attached to, the new main characters. I love the character of Rey.
Let's put it this way.
Poe and Finn.
Yeah.
And all of our conversation pretty much leaving the movie last night was about Rey.
That's true. Well, let's put it this way. As powerful as that scene is, it was weird. It was the third viewing when I actually did shed a few tears during that scene. And the moment that triggered it was not was twofold. It was Chewie right after he stabbed through the heart, but also Rey's reaction. Because in such a short amount of time, you know who we've fallen in love with? Who's the hero of this movie? It's Rey in an incredible way. And her reaction sells the scene in a really unexpected way because we've just been introduced to her in this movie. But yet her reaction and her crying out was what moved me just as much as Chewie's reaction and Chewie crying out. And that for me was just a testament to what an instantly engaging and sympathetic and charismatic character that Daisy Ridley has portrayed in Rey in just an incredible way. And I don't remember if I said it last week, but even if I did, it bears repeating. You have one of cinema's greatest action hero icon, the charisma bomb that is Harrison Ford. He is Indiana Jones. He is Jack Ryan. He is Han Solo. And in this film, he is, not to take anything away from Harrison Ford, he is outshone by Daisy Ridley in a beautiful and brilliant way. So I want to take some time to talk about the character of Rey.
This is exactly how I planned. I was like, I'm going to try to move the whole conversation to Rey so that I can talk about her more.
Everything is proceeding as I have foreseen.
Exactly.
Because Rey's an interesting character on so many levels, and kind of a lot of the conversation has turned to her being too powerful or overpowered in some ways, but I don't even really think that that's, again, worth addressing, because that's not the point of the film. The thing about Rey is that she's the centerpiece of this film. She's the hero embarking on the hero's journey in the style of Joseph Campbell. If you don't understand that, you're going to misinterpret a lot of her journey and her force abilities that she acquires. Even to last night's screening, I was talking to Bethany, like, of her journey, the only part that I had any quibble with was, again, it was almost more of an editing thing than it was anything else, was how quickly she was totally overpowered and captured on Maz Kanata's planet, and then within 5 minutes of the editing of the movie, she's overpowering her captor very easily. But upon further reflection, I think that really just points to how much Rey is a classic example of Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. And of course, if you guys aren't familiar with The Hero with a Thousand Faces, it's Joseph Campbell's work that heavily influenced George Lucas that talks about the hero's journey that is present throughout so much of history and so much of storytelling. That, you know, has that process of starting. Here's the main thing. The main point of Rey's journey is that she starts as a nobody from simple beginnings and is launched into a mystical transformation into an incredible hero that we can all love and root for. And that's the point of this film. If you don't take that away, then yes, so you might have problems with certain technical things. But that, for me, is the amazing part about Rey that I think she does absolute justice to.
Well, and her co-stars do a great job of helping her, too. I mean, you know, Finn, Rey, and Poe, the three of them, they stand up on their own. I mean, you got the bromance between Poe and Finn that just adds levels of humor. I mean, Poe is kind of like the slapstick guy. But there is a moment when Kylo Ren gets Rey and he's walking her onto his ship and Finn is running across. And this one on the second viewing also brought me near to tears because he's screaming her name and running as fast as he can trying to get there. And, you know, he hasn't even known her that long, but the connection there, you know, it hasn't been that long through the film, and yet you've watched them have these momentary connections. And I just, again, when they finally come and get her and then they hug and that momentary hug when she's clinging on to him and stuff, you know, and Han's going, okay, big deal, we got to go. But
it's so
just the reaction to the other characters to her and stuff really got to me as well.
Yeah.
And think about this, in that moment, for the first time
in forever,
for the first time, she someone came back for her. She spent all those years waiting on Jakku. Gesundheit, on Jakku to have her family return, and it never comes to pass, but now she does.
Man, Before the Awakening has a great, it's almost a heart-rending little ending to her tale, and it's along those lines, because she wants to stay, because she knows that if she stays, it's the only place her parents will know where she's at. And I was just like, oh, what an end. Oh, man, because like, I don't want to spoil it. Everybody out there, you should find this book. It's three little short stories, and Poe's and Rey's were a lot better than I thought they would. Well, Poe's, I was expecting goodness, but Rey's was a lot more heart-wrenching than I thought, but it was a really good story. And all the way around, it does a great job of setting up things that a lot of those naysayers missed, and a lot of it's there, like, you know, why Finn was feeling the way he was, why Poe was doing what he was doing, why the Resistance is the Resistance, and why it's not part of the New Republic. A lot of really interesting political background stuff is in the midst of that. Greg Rucka did a very good job. It's just a shame that they waited until the day of to release that book. That book should have had the Journey of the Force Awakens slapped on it, because that was probably the only book out of the 20 that really did the job.
Nice. That's awesome, man. Well, enough of us dudes blabbing on about Rey. Bethany, your thoughts on the new hero of Star Wars?
Well,
being a chick, she's a girl, and she's awesome.
Yes, she is. I believe it was Harrison Ford himself who, when asked what he thought of Daisy Ridley, he said, she's awesome and cute. And both are true.
It's a fair point,
of Daisy
ladies
Ridley
and gentlemen.
And of Rey.
A fair point.
But the thing with Rey is that she's something that so many movies don't have anymore. She is very much like Captain America, or very much like Aragorn from the Lord of the Rings in the book version of Aragorn. I'll clarify. That just made it too nerdy. But the thing that you can have a hero who has a few flaws, but for the most part, their intentions are pure. Their goal is pure, and they desperately want to do the right thing. And it works. It really does work. You don't have to have a character like Jessica Jones, who is the entire opposite, I would say, in some ways. And yet still, the Jessica Jones character works really well. But I appreciate the fact that Rey, as Luke, is someone who you could be best friends with in 5 minutes and have a complete trust and respect of their characters.
Yeah.
And Rey fits that quite perfectly, as Luke did in the original trilogy. So I'm amazed by the character of Rey, because she is... she is vulnerable in the sense of she's waiting for the family to come back that never will. She is deceiving herself in waiting years and years. And especially Maz Kanata points out, deep down, she knows the truth. Deep down, she understands, but she can't admit it to herself.
Yeah.
And that's, you could say that that's a shortcoming, but more so it makes her human.
Yeah.
Because there are always things that we do not want to admit to ourselves. And it makes sense that Rey, who is young and inexperienced and her family.
I can't go to Alderaan. I've got one more season, right? You know,
yeah.
Exactly. It's right out of the same playbook.
Yep.
But logic's at play here. I mean, logically, if your parents lose you, you're to hug a tree. You're supposed to stay in that one place till they come back. So she's fighting the logic there. You know, what parent wouldn't come back for their kid? And yet there's that other side of her that is like, they're not coming back. It's this long. What parent wouldn't go this long without coming back? She knows her parents would have come back if they could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's at play. I mean, that's a brilliant move there. You know, you mentioned Jessica Jones and Rey, and the similarities and differences. And the one similarity that I find is that they're both strong with confidence. You know, I mean, that was something about Rey's character that just immediately stood out. It was like, she was struggling to get by. She was all alone and these were all terrible things, but she was doing it.
Yeah.
You know, it was still a struggle, but she was doing it.
And like Luke, when thrust into a conflict of a galactic scale with so much resting on her shoulder, she rises to that challenge, just like Luke did. There is hesitation. There is struggling.
She runs. Like, when first confronted with it, she runs, just like Luke. Mm-hmm. then it must be nowhere coming, or I just forgot the line. I'm so terrible with quoting the original trilogy. I always feel terrible about it. But it's like the moment when Luke runs back to the moisture farm, and he's forced onto the adventure. Not unlike Rey, who's like, no, I'm not going to be part of this. Then she's kidnapped by the villain of the movie and literally knocked out and tossed over the shoulder.
Yes, but if you think about it, she's kidnapped because she went back for her friends when she thought they were in danger.
That's true. She went back when
she saw the First Order rising or coming down to the planet, I should
say. First Order rise.
Here's a great moment too from Before the Awakenings with her. She cobbles together a computer and finds a program that has a flight simulator.
I've heard
this
about
this. Part of how she gets her piloting. But what was really cool was the way her brain worked. She would get really good at doing all the basic things and then would go out of her way to make things hard. So she would do scenarios where she would purposely cripple her ship and see if she could get through it to get even better and better. And I was like, it was exactly kind of like what I had seen of her on the film. I was like, that's kind of clever. Way to go, Rey. You know, you see her on that first scene with Jake when she's sliding down the thing. She's got a makeshift, you know, she's got a makeshift everything. It's like the girl is smart.
And I saw a parallel with Anakin that I really liked in her, which is because she's a scavenger and she knows about the Millennium Falcon already. She's like, that ship hasn't run in years. And she mentions to Finn in the movie that, I've flown some ships before, but I've never flown
out of
the planet or something.
British accent.
I don't remember exactly. Yeah. But so she has flown before and she's familiar with ships, which tells me not only is she a scavenger, but because of her familiarity with mechanics and parts and pieces, she must also, like Anakin, be used to fiddling around with ships and parts and pieces as well. And I think that Unkar Platt. Yes, I think he's been slowly upping the prices to where now all she's left with is desperately trying to scavenge enough in a day to make enough food to survive on. And especially once he sees that she has BB-8, because he's going to try to force her into selling BB-8.
And her hunger, you're going to have a great appreciation for it too once you read that book. I think you, especially Bethany, being a fan of Rey, I think anybody who's a fan of Rey and Poe are really going to get a kick out of that book.
Nice. Well, and as a little teaser, as we're recording this tonight, it's the 27th, we are interviewing, I should say we, I'm acting as producer. Mark is headlining a special interview with the author of Before the Awakening. Before the Awakening? Mm-hmm. Did I get it right?
Yep, Before the Awakening.
Yes,
Greg.
Look at that. I will be acting as producer and recorder while you...
Beyond the Awakening, between the Awakening.
Which, by the way, makes me so happy because, like, instead of someone else being on the PR line who's like, let's connect you with the interviewee and we'll get everything set up, it'll be me on our side of the line saying, I'm the producer, I'm Riley Blanton, I'll be in the background making sure all the recording is going well. Let me put you on the line with our guy.
Our man on the spot.
A little bit of inside baseball there.
That's funny.
But yeah, well, and we touched on it briefly, but let's not gloss over this Force vision. Because that probably the central turning point of the episode.
I don't think I've blinked during the Force vision at any viewing so far.
No,
I've just been staring.
There's so much to it, and it's so purposely vague in a lot of ways. Darth Hound's in the chat.
So much that
about
you're
it
from, seeing and hearing. You're like, wait, was that Obi-Wan? Was that Alec Guinness? Oh my gosh. Am I hearing Ewan McGregor too?
Rey? It's Darth Hound's in the chat talking about it. There's a little bit more detail in the novelization. I love the fact that it's not very detailed, and I love the fact that it's the turning point of the film. For Rey, it's her burning homestead moment. Even though she's confronted with it and initially runs, that's her first instinct. It's still that moment where we realize as an audience, and she realizes, her destiny. And she balks at it. And not with a bad reason, because I don't know if you guys figured this out. Kylo Ren, not the nicest dude out there. Like, if it's your destiny to get Luke Skywalker's lightsaber, go find him. Like, she, you know, not 45 minutes ago in the movie, she thinks he's a myth, right? And so now it's like her destiny to retrieve Luke's lightsaber. Like, that's got to be super overwhelming. And it was, her reaction is more than warranted. And that force vision, like, you see it. And I didn't even notice it till like the second viewing. Like, it flashes to the corridor on Bespin. Where Vader and Luke fight and confront each other, and you hear Yoda's voice and Alec Guinness's voice calling out, "Rey, don't be afraid." That's what they pulled it from. And then you hear Ewan McGregor's voice as he comes in, and you hear him say, "It's your first steps. Mm-hmm. And this is like this really, really cool force vision, the likes of which we've never seen in a Star Wars movie. We've kind of seen something like it in Revenge of the Sith. We've kind of seen something like it in Empire Strikes Back, when Luke has sort of the vision of his friends being hurt. But it's vivid, it's riveting, and it's very layered. It really takes repeated viewings to appreciate it as the true turning point for Rey's character.
Well, if you think about it, too, one reason why it's so obvious that the Force is awakening within Rey is definitely that vision, and the fact that the lightsaber is calling to her. The fact that she, who has never had anything like a Force vision prior to this point, because that's obvious because of how terrified she is of it and how much it startles and scares her. She's definitely not familiar with Force visions. And she goes on to have a full-on Force vision where she's immersed in what she's seeing. This isn't a, you know, Obi-Wan calling out to Luke through the Force in a voice only that Luke listens to. This is full-on Force vision of multiple events involving multiple people that Rey feels
involving
immersed in.
Past and future, which is another interesting element,
yes,
I think.
Yes, and an inanimate object is the thing that the Force is using as a conduit for this vision. Not a powerful Force user like Obi-Wan Kenobi. So, to me, it shows that in that, and the fact that Rey swiftly and steadily grows more powerful to the point that Kylo and Snoke, as powerful Force users, notice it before they even meet her, and then continue to notice it once Kylo does meet her, shows a lot, I think. And that's... I was almost afraid when I saw the movie the first time.
Don't be afraid.
And
Rey.
Rey closes her eyes in the middle of the lightsaber duel and opens them again. And I thought, oh man, she's feeling the Force now. She's fully using it as opposed to just partially using it. She's attempting to use it instead of the Force just using her to some degree.
Do you guys think, though, that if she's going to end up becoming, you know, Anakin's ancestor in some form, if she happens to be Luke's kid, for example, do you think that that's the only explanation for why she's a threat? Or,
well, and maybe the fact
I'm looking at it like this, like
he was shot through
her being Luke makes sense. If she was just anyone else, you know, any other person that just happened to have Force sensitivity, all of a sudden her Force sensitivity is awaking and growing exponentially. That seems a little expanded universe. That doesn't seem like something we would get out of canon.
It's, well,
but
certainly not
the Chosen One's grandchild having that happen, that kind of makes more sense to me. You know, I've heard people throw around the theory that, well, maybe she's Ben Kenobi's daughter, which I throw out. He was long dead way before then, so it really can't be. But what do you guys think about that? Like,
it would probably have to be.
Do you think all the Jedi, anybody out there with Force sensitivity, is going to be having an exponential, hey, drop your blaster.
I was going to say just really briefly, my personal opinion is, my personal theory is that she's a Skywalker. And I think there's a lot that points to that. There's pretty good theory behind she could be a Solo, that Han Solo never knew he had a daughter. He and Leia were separated and she never told him. And that Leia knows.
His racing ears, huh?
Yeah, which is interesting. But I think the most likely explanation would be that she's a Skywalker, which I think would be cool. Bethany, you're going to say?
Oh, just the fact that in the movie a couple of times, you will notice Rey doing movements that most normal people would not do. For instance, in the very first scene that we see her in, when she jumps off that little, like outcropping of metal where she's scavenging from, she jumps a good, like at least 5 feet, probably more like 8.
Oh yeah, that's true. That is a nice little
reach
leap.
That rope and grabs it and slides down. And in the, mm-hmm. in the Death Star, or the Death Star on Starkiller Base, she does not hesitate to essentially hop over the side and start clambering down this slick metal where she's finding these tiny little footholds and handholds.
That's true.
I think
I knew exactly which one to activate too. That was odd.
Much like Anakin, she does use the Force unconsciously in her physical movements.
I'm the only human who can do it. Sorry, not to bring in the Phantom Menace.
And she can. We don't know how long she's been doing it, but as Darth Hound points out, she's dreaming of an ocean and an island, which is almost certainly Luke's island for some time before she even meets Kylo.
Yep. In fact, Bethany, your theory is that because we touched on it briefly, your theory is that Kylo Ren's mind invasion actually enabled the Force to awaken in her, and that's where she kind of learned or figured out the Jedi mind trick movement, and suddenly began, she was able to, instead of being overpowered, take in what he was doing and really reflect that back at him using the Force.
JJ hints at that too in one of the articles.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I love that. You know what the one thing I think was missing, really small, that would have just really, I think, made a huge difference, is right at the end on the precipice in the duel with Kylo Ren, if you had just heard the ghostly voice of Maz Kanata, or better yet, like Ewan McGregor's Obi-Wan. But I think Maz Kanata would work because we heard it in the trailer, but the Force is calling to you, just let it in. Just to have that nice parallel with A New Hope, and then her eyes open and she fights him off, to where there's sort of that really solidifies the idea of this mysterious concept of the Force being dormant and then awakening.
Well, and I think from the moment that she hears the lightsaber's call, that's when the Force truly awakens in her. But it is her... I don't think the Force awakens when she meets Kylo or when he invades her mind. I think it's already awoken in her, but having him invade her mind, and he doesn't realize at first that she's a Force user, is because he only barely touches her mind briefly on the planet. And so it's and I think that's enough to, he's already intrigued by her. You know, when he finds out, you know, tell me about this girl. And then when he faces her for the first time, he's like, I've heard a lot about you. And so he's already a little bit intrigued by her. Like, why is this random scavenger girl running around with a trained
But he seems to figure it out pretty quickly when he's telling the stormtrooper. He's like, the longer she's out there, the more powerful she becomes.
Well, because that's after the second time that he enters her mind. And he's being careless because he's immature and insecure, and he thinks of himself as more powerful than anyone else.
He sort of seems like a street magician version of a Sith Lord,
and
right?
So
he's like, he's got a handful of cool tricks up his sleeve, but he's really not that skilled.
In being, in carelessly entering her mind, and think of this, he thinks that pretty much every other Force user in the galaxy is dead, with the exception of Luke Skywalker and possibly Snoke. We don't know. We know Snoke is Force sensitive. We don't know how trained he is necessarily, but
well, there is a moment in the book, and Hound confirmed it because I thought I'd heard the same thing, where when Ren is confronting Rey, he says it is you, and there is a lot of emphasis on is, kind of alluding that he actually recognized her.
I was gonna say so he's all like C-3PO, Rey, it is you, it is you.
But
well, I know in Star Wars Infinity, they thought that they had confirmation of the word cousin, but it turned out it wasn't. I know when I listened to that, I was all like, oh, I heard it. But no, it was him saying curses. But, I, you know, that wasn't an angle that I honestly did not give any credence to that thought before I watched the movie. The angle of them being cousins, I you know, David Senden has been telling me that on Facebook for the longest time. They're going to be cousins. Oh, yeah, right. now I'm actually like, hey, you know, them being cousins is probably the angle that I'm most hoping for. But I do find it interesting that of, you know, all the characters that they did not give us their names, you know, we knew there was a first name for Finn and we knew there was a first name for Rey. And then we later found out that, oh, Kylo Ren is just a pseudonym. It's not really his name. And yet, of all that, we only found out Kylo Ren's actual name, and we found out that Finn never really had a name. And yet, Rey, we still are kind of like, well, what? Wait, who? What? So yeah. Again, you know, I'm hoping when we find out who her mom is, I'm like, please be a Jaina Jade.
keep hoping, Mark. Keep hoping. man, there's some great pop dialogue too. Like, there's some really corny, awesome Star Warsy Lawrence Kasdan style dialogue. It's like, good to meet you, Finn. Good to meet you too, Poe. Or vice versa, I guess what it was. But there's some great moments. And we won't do justice in our review here looking at the clock. We've got the interview coming up with Greg Rucka. I want to touch on Finn because, like, again, there's such a beautiful sequence at the beginning of this film that introduces all of our characters with the exception of Rey in such a quick, succinct, amazing fashion where you instantly understand who they are and what they're doing without an overemphasis on it. And that's, of course, the scene where starts with BB-8 spotting the stormtroopers running in to tell his master. And then you see the exchange between you meet Poe and the exchange of him as the hotshot pilot. And you're like, you immediately know who he is. And then within minutes, the stormtroopers land and you're introduced to Finn, who, as he said in the trailer, and not the movie, I was raised to do one thing. And so it's his first battle, as we learn later in the film. And when his friend dies, his poor unnamed stormtrooper friend dies, and we see blood, which is a very rare thing to see in Star Wars, as he reaches his hand up, which is such a brilliant narrative move, because then, of course, for the rest of the scene, you can know exactly who Finn is. We're introduced to this really, really lovable, funny, engaging,
endearing.
And again, endearing. That's a great word.
Excited.
Guy who was kidnapped as a child, and he's basically a child soldier who then was enslaved in sanitation on something 10 times bigger than the Death Star. Like, talk about a rough background for a character that just you fall in love with so much.
See, and we thought that was his first battle, but again, before the awakening, we find out that's actually his second. The first one he went on was where he decided that things need to change. He'd had this thought that there might be something wrong with him. And it does, Greg does a great job of setting all this up. But the other one is FN2003, which is nicknamed Slip. And Slip was nicknamed Slip because he was always slipping up. And the First Order, they had initiated this thing where it was like, you know, once they started to get closer to going to war, everything about what they were doing had changed. And that was something that Finn was thinking about. And then they did that first mission and it was a literal, you know, kill him kind of thing. And he didn't shoot. In fact, it was Slip that did it and Slip got props for it. And you're like, oh, Phasma's watching Finn. And then you go into that other mission and it totally changes up everything you think about Finn in that moment. When Finn takes off his helmet and he's sweating, you suddenly realize why he's sweating, because you have all this background information about Finn. Of all the troopers in his unit, he's the only one that didn't give himself a nickname. And in fact, they end up, when they get onto their first Star Destroyer, they're with what they consider real stormtroopers, you know, the veterans. And when they're asked their names, you know, everyone gives their nickname and Finn is just FN2187. And he's like, let me guess, you're the one in charge. And they're like, yep. And he's like, yeah, you just don't fit in. Like, there's this great little background between them. And it really plays into what's going on in Finn's mind and the turmoil that the character has that is just absent in
also,
that first scene. Like,
yeah.
Oh, great.
I didn't even notice this until the fourth viewing, but 2187. FN2187. 2187. Star Wars number reference.
If I can make an observation about the way that Finn is received by everyone. They keep calling him a lovable dork, which I would agree to, because he can be very dorky.
He's totally
sometimes.
That. But, he's always in over his head, too, and it's awesome. It's hilarious.
He's in over his head, and it is hilarious, but we're comparing him as viewers to probably one of the most powerful Force users to be born in the last 30 years or so, which is Rey. Someone who has probably ever since she was 4 or 5, maybe 6, when we see her with Unkar Platt being dragged away from the ship where her parents are being taken away or are leaving. She, like Anakin, has probably been working with machines since she was 5. And so she's really smart with them. And she's been defending herself, too, because we see she's pretty darn good with that staff, even before she really has the Force wake up in her.
Yeah.
And then we're comparing him also to, as we're blatantly told, the Resistance best pilot, and who's experienced war for forever.
Because he can kind of actually hold his own.
And we see that Finn has been trained as a stormtrooper quite well. You know, he does hold his own in the
battle
melee
that should have been against Captain Phasma, but
yes,
wasn't.
Yes, that battle. And also against, albeit an injured, Ren. But he figures out that weapon system quite fast for just being told very quickly. And he figures out other things very quickly, too. He's willing. He goes after Rey. He is afraid to face Ren, but he faces his own fear very quickly. And the reason he is so afraid of the First Order is because of all the people there, with the exception of Maz Kanata, who has probably 975-ish years on him or something, and Han Solo, who has experienced it all, he knows best what true threat the First Order is.
Yeah. No, he does. As he says at the table right there.
I think he's a lot smarter and quicker to the uptake than a lot of us fans really realize, especially
that's fair viewing. That's definitely fair.
He's like, definitely a lovable dork, but he's a very smart, fast-thinking, quick to the uptake, lovable dork.
But he does carry so many of the film's most comedic moments, which is probably why we think of him that way.
That's personality-wise.
Like the thumbs up with BB-8. That's such a great moment. Or the, I'm in charge, Phasma. I'm in charge.
Yeah.
See, and that I'm in charge moment, I had more appreciation for that after reading Finn's part of the book because of the interactions with Phasma. That angle that you're talking about, Bethany, is really played up in that book, because when Slip starts screwing up, Finn was kind of going out of his way to pick up the slack, and she recognizes that. And she's like, why are you doing that? And he's like, well, you know, we're only as good as our weakest link. And she goes, absolutely. And you're just making that weakest link not get better. You know, you're enabling it, is kind of what she says. So she makes it where he can't help. And he starts noticing, like, every time Slip screws up, everyone gets punished. So the First Order makes it where they're all starting to hate Slip. And he's like, he starts to think, you know, are they doing this on purpose? And I mean, everything about what he's seeing, the First Order is working, and the level of terror that they're seeding into things subtly, you know, I mean, because Slip is afraid he's going to screw up. So he's giving whole heart to the First Order. He's like, you know, like that moment when Hux is doing his thing and you're like, wow, they look like the Nazis and they're doing the whole Hail Hitler thing. I mean, that Slip, he's like giving it his all. Like, look how into this I am. I'm, you know, I'm your best guy. I know I'm screwing up, but hey guys, I'm giving it my all.
Yeah.
And Finn sees that. He's like, what is going on here?
Yeah. Wow. That's he's such a great character, and so many of the film's best comedic moments are with him.
What if Darth Hound and Red Five Mom were just suggesting that whoever Rey's waiting for are not her parents, but somebody else? And I just had a thought. What if somehow Rey, who is a Solo or a Skywalker,
she says family. She says it like that too.
It
family.
Was placed in the care of someone a la Leia with the Organas, or Luke with his uncle and aunt. What if the people who left her on the planet were adoptive parents or guardians and were not her real parents?
What if Luke Skywalker has the kid, but thinks the kid was killed by Kylo Ren, kid was rescued by an unnamed mysterious hero, Max von Sydow's character, who's also on Jakku, by the way, who is then whisked off into hiding that Luke can't know that she exists, because if he does, it risks that Ben Solo, a.k.a. Kylo Ren, finds out that she exists and that there's a daughter. So that's why there's the possible recognition, as Darth Hound is pointing out in the chat, especially in the novel, of Kylo Ren is like he senses maybe some sort of familiarity so that she's waiting for her family, as she says it so eloquently.
Kylo Ren is 30 years old. Rey is 19, so at around the time Ben Solo fell to the dark side and wiped out what little Jedi Order Luke was working on, that would have been around the time she was left. The theory I had is that Rey was the product of like a one-night stand, maybe, but I'm beginning to think that less and less, because she was deliberately left there, but in the vision, it looks like she was left with Uther, or whatever his name was, the junk dealer.
Unkar Plutt. Platt. Unkar Plutt.
He seemed to be the one holding on to her, and it seemed to be his voice going, "Let go, girl," or something.
No, that was definitely him. That was him upon repeated viewings. Yeah.
And I see him a lot like Watto.
I can't quite put together, you know, why they would put her there.
Well, again, what if she was placed under the care of guardians who, for some reason, had to leave or were kidnapped and forced to leave?
And
Unkar Plutt then takes advantage and is like, awesome, I have a little 5-year-old slave to, much like Watto with Anakin.
What if she is the product of a in-depth, deep and passionate affair with a member of the Zagwavian Death Gang? There's the theory, ladies and gentlemen. Or maybe Conjure Club. Tell that to Conjure Club. I love that guy.
Now, what I want to know is I saw a picture, and I don't know if it's real, but there's a picture. She supposedly has a twin sister, Kiki, or something like that. And if it's true, I'm just like, man, if they do a clone story down the road with a dark clone of Rey, I'll be like, okay.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. I apologize, folks. We kind of got a little bit outlandish there. But suffice to say, Finn's awesome. I cannot wait to see what he does. And there's, of course, I don't know. What do you guys think of what do you guys think of maybe the possibility of him being force sensitive? Or do you think that's hogwash?
Well, he was definitely the Leia-like character of the big three in this, because, you know, Rey turns out she's actually the Luke style, and, you know, Poe's the good pilot Han, and what do we got, Finn? Oh, he's the guy that could possibly be a Jedi but isn't.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's nothing to say that he's definitely not a force sensitive, but at the same time, I think it would be a little odd to sort of, from a storytelling standpoint, if I were J.J. Abrams, it would seem awfully convenient to just randomly endow him with force powers and then also not use them or hint at them in this movie at all.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. And then, Bentley, I want to ask you this question before we move on from Finn and tackle our last piece of conversation, which is, of course, has to be about Luke. And we're going to get to him in a second. But let me ask, do you think, did you read any of the interaction throughout the film as constructing, I won't even say overtly, but possibly constructing any kind of romantic interest or connection between Rey and Finn?
Oh, definitely. I think that...
Could this be love?
I think that Finn has a crush on Rey.
The love! Got a cute boyfriend?
Almost the first moment that he sees her, because she is kicking butt, and he sees this adorable girl trying to protect this adorable little droid from being taken, and she puts up a good fight, knocks him out, and then immediately kneels in front of BB-8, and she's like, are you okay? Is everything all right? And then when she finds out that the droid's master is probably in big trouble because this random dude is standing there wearing his jacket, she immediately races after him.
That's a great moment, too.
She immediately races after Finn to go out of her way to, again, do something nice for BB-8. So we see that she is a truly kind character. Yeah. And I think Finn sees that, too. Finn is impressed.
Well, and Finn is there to impress her, and he's not above maybe telling more than a few white lies to do so. He's like, I'm with the Resistance. I am with the Resistance. Yeah, Resistance fighters, they look like me. Well, not all of them. And it's the moment she's so, like, impressed, right? She's like, I've never met a Resistance fighter before.
Yeah. and so he great. Immediately just, like, kind of puffs up a little bit. He's so excited.
That's right. Women always figure out the truth. Always.
Oh, man, that was a great moment. You know, another thing that the book points out, too, kind of hints at, when Ray and Poe meet, there's kind of some friction there that could lead to like a relationship angle as well, because they had that whole run in and she recognized who he was. It was an interesting little moment that I was like, oh, they could have had that. You had that whole, you know, Han and Luke both pining after Leia kind of thing.
Well, and I
Red Five Mom said she liked Poe's face.
I thought it was a little sad that we didn't get much Finn, Rey, and Poe friendship, like the three of them together in the movie. I definitely want to see that happen, because Finn is a great friend to Rey, and Finn has also become fast friends with Poe, which I loved. I loved how quickly they became friends. And it was a true friendship too. They just hit it off immediately. It was bromance on a scale of 1 to 10. It was on a 12. And, so I want to see the three of them become friends, and maybe Rey might be a little hesitant of other people in the resistance at first, you know, because of everything she's been through. But, I can kind of see her, I don't know. That would be so cool to see the three of them have adventures together.
Yeah, no, there's definitely a chemistry there that has to be when it comes to Star Wars, because that's what really carries, you know, the original trilogy so much. And, you know, it's a big part of what makes the first act of Empire so amazing and the last act so tragic, is because our heroes get separated.
Yeah.
And that's also probably, I think, compounds why it's so tragic in this film that they never get reunited. But we have a potential to at least maybe capture some measure of the magic with the new
Well,
folks.
And if you think about Rey as well, like Finn is immediately taken with her, and she starts to really care about Finn, but she doesn't really fully trust him, especially once he leaves and tells her that he's not with the resistance. You can tell she has an understanding, but there's also some disappointment there. Even though she does go back to try to help Finn and Han and Chewie once the First Order ships show up. But the thing with her was, she was able to fully trust Finn when he realized a great danger to himself and no reason to do so except to do so for her. He comes back for her with the double meaning of he's the first one to come back for her.
Yeah, and Chewie Chewie's all sticking up for him.
Yeah.
He's like the ultimate wingman.
Yeah,
Chewie's like, yeah, he came back for you. And that's a really endearing moment.
Girl, give him a hug now. That was that hug I was talking about. I mean, when she grabbed on to him, Daisy really did such a good job of making that moment feel genuine.
Yeah.
And even John, I mean, the two of them really did. I think that's my thing with John all the way around, though. I mean, everything about his little reactions, like, sometimes you thought, like, well, maybe he's doing a little overacting, but no, he's being genuine. When he's being drugged through Han's other ship by that monster and Rey cuts the door off and he's trying to get the tentacle off as fast as he can, he's like, did you see that? Did you just see that? I mean, I was laughing so hard at his reactions, because, you know, he was somebody out of his element, yet should be in his element. It was like, clearly some of these things are the first time he's done it, and those were great moments. But yeah, that hug and the closeness in that bond really sold that moment there. And you're right, Bethany, that is that moment, especially with how her character was clinging to him, the fact that he came back. And you could see that just in that hug, that great bear hug of a moment.
And I love, he gets the biggest smile on his face when she hugs him, because it is really the first moment where she fully trusts him. Obviously, she's cared about him and she's tried to help him and stuff, but that's the first moment of, you know, she goes from liking him to probably that's the start of their deep friendship.
Yes, and that's what it is at this point. And it can, I think it leaves room to transform beyond that. But
well,
it doesn't,
and obviously
it's not too,
Finn would probably like it to transform beyond that.
Well, maybe, yeah, I think that's fair to say. But I think overall, it just leaves it in a nice place where they weren't too leading in that direction, where it could have become a little bit too much of a tension point in the story. And I liked that. Guys, we got to talk about Luke Skywalker. Like before we, because I don't want to, this is one segment I do not want to cut short because like the.
Well, since you won't cut that short, I got to ask a question to the chat that's along this lines of what we're talking about before we go and to you guys, because you'll be able to answer it first. At the end of the movie, after we learn someone dies and they get back to the Resistance base, Chewie and Rey get off the Falcon. Chewie walks right past Leia. Leia walks right past Chewie, and Leia walks up to Rey. Do you guys think there's any significance to the fact that Chewie and Leia walked right past each other after knowing this whole Han's death, and Leia went to Rey above everyone else?
I think Chewie feels guilty.
Yeah. I think it's anything with Leia.
Chewie feels guilty because
it's his life debt.
He couldn't save Han.
Yeah, and that was his sworn life debt, and he failed. Tragically, not really through any fault of his own. But I think that's it more than anything that's going on specifically between him and Leia. That's a tough scene, and it's tough to follow. But I'm so glad that they didn't. I mean, they could have really ended on a cliffhanger if they wanted to there, but they didn't. And we do get a glimpse of Luke Skywalker right in the last part of the film. And I'm so glad that they did this because in the behind the scenes, in a lot of the articles that I've been reading and hearing about, that there were several drafts that had Luke Skywalker entering the film earlier in the movie. But what happened every time that was the case is that he kind of took over the story and overshadowed Rey as a central character. So
and probably
I loved,
overshadowed Han.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so I loved that it was brilliantly done, and that instead of the map being the MacGuffin, which it sort of is, but the real MacGuffin, the real plot thrust of this whole movie, that, you know, is the first sentence in the opening crawl, Luke Skywalker is missing. He's gone, disappeared. And he's in self-imposed exile, not unlike, his forefathers of the Jedi Order, Obi-Wan and Yoda. And it fits to me perfectly. And they mentioned kind of casually, and I have a sense that Rian Johnson has a lot of work to do on episode 8 on this very topic, but that he went off after hiding in anger, grief, and resignation after the destruction of his attempt to rebuild the Jedi Order. He went off in search of the first Jedi Temple. And if you ask me, kind of looks like he found it. They're off Kerry, County Kerry, Ireland. This is evidently where the last Jedi Temple is. But how about that moment, Bethany? I was going to say, especially the first time we see it, were you getting towards the end of the film wondering, are we just not going to see Luke?
I realized that once we had the map, I was like, I bet we're going to see him at the very end. But I didn't necessarily know how that would look. And, oh man, but that scene with Luke, it was so emotional, and I know it was just a few seconds, but Mark Hamill acted it to perfection.
I say best supporting actor right now goes to Mark Hamill just for the 30-second look.
And I mean, as a fan, I want to be like, I want more Luke. I wish there had been more Luke in the movie. But at the same time, even with that, well, you know, they could have made a 6-hour movie and I would have been very happy. So I say there's all these things that I want, but it's just because a fan and I want more, not because I necessarily think, oh, the story lacked because of it. I don't think that's the case. But oh man, his moment on screen was perfection, and it was so moving as well. And Rey in that scene was moving. She is reaching out for help and guidance. And she's very emotional when she first sees Luke. And that again goes back to who did she hear the stories of old from, that she has so much excitement for Han Solo and the Millennium Falcon and Luke Skywalker and the Jedi were real.
The rebellion fighter?
No,
the smuggler.
Bedtime stories to your 3-year-old. That's how.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. You know who wasn't telling her bedtime stories of Luke Skywalker is Unkar Platt. Plutt. I keep forgetting.
Splat. Yes.
A Simon Splat is what I'm going to call him.
I just got to say, in general, I'll be happy with Star Wars moving away from MacGuffins as plots, because it seems like of late, that seems to be their quick go-to thing. I mean, going back even to the Millennium Falcon book, you know, it's like, hey, let's have a MacGuffin. There's something we haven't done in a week. Let's do another MacGuffin story. Okay, hey, we're going to do a new film. We haven't done a MacGuffin in a film yet. Okay, let's do it. Like, I'm done with MacGuffins now.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh man. As far as Luke goes, I do wonder. Obviously, there's the driving factor of why would he leave everyone for so long? Yes, even given the tragedy that happened. Why did he seek out the first Jedi temple? What answers is he looking for? What is he looking for from the Jedi as opposed to just pulling a Han and just kind of running around the galaxy and doing whatever?
So Bethany, JJ hints that part of that is that now, because the Force is out of balance, Luke recognizes the dark side in himself. Therefore, basically, after those events, the stuff that drove him away, the anger, grief, the pain, he recognizes that he's vulnerable to the dark side. So he's removed himself from the equation. I think he's going to the first Jedi temple or seeking the first Jedi temple because I think he's trying to seek the training that Yoda didn't give him. The training that, in a sense, he screwed himself out of because he had to go off to go and save Luke and Han. You know, Yoda was like, you can't go. Your training's going to be incomplete. You know, Yoda was like begging him not to go. And I think that's what he's desperately looking for right now is like, okay, clearly I shouldn't have left. There's something I'm missing. And I think the dark emotions and stuff and the fact that there's a dark side living in Luke Skywalker, I think it terrifies him. And I think that's why he's removed himself completely. The thing that gets me is I'm curious when episode 8 starts, you've got Rey standing on one side of the top of that mountain holding out the lightsaber. You got Luke on the other. Who says what and what do they say? Because that's a weird moment.
Yeah.
Who are you, girl?
I can tell you.
Does she just lose it and run up and hug him? Does he lose it and just like continue staring at her in shock and the lightsaber that was his father's?
I can tell you, I don't know. I can tell you exactly what she says. And she's like, how's this work? You talk?
Skywalker's going to wave his hand and he's going to say, I'm not the Jedi you're looking for. And she's going to walk back down. R2 will be like, oh, well, he said he wasn't the Jedi I was looking for.
Oh my goodness. Wow. We've learned a lot on this episode of the Star Wars Report. Man, what a fun time really getting in depth on this film. Wow. I've had an absolute blast, guys. Thanks so much for joining me. Thanks everybody who tuned in live. And Bethany.
Oh, because I have one more thing to say and I can't help but say it.
Go for it.
Who does that headstone belong to?
I know.
I'm
that's true.
So curious.
We will just have
Jaina
to.
Jaina Jade.
We will have to find out Rian Johnson in a year and a half. Less than a year and a half now. Folks, that puts the wraps on this episode of the Star Wars Report podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. We've had an absolute blast, folks. And if you've enjoyed this podcast and our reviews, we've got a lot more stuff coming. Some more special guests coming up in January. All kinds of great stuff that's going to be going on. And I'm super excited. We've got some really great folks that are going to be coming on the show very soon. I can't drop any names quite yet because we're finalizing it, but some really cool stuff's happening. Folks, if you want to support us and you enjoy this stuff, by all means, we really do want your support. You can do it directly. If you go to patreon.com/StarWarsReport, you can support us there or leave us an iTunes review. Either of those helps.
Can I ask a question?
I just want to say, yes.
What does that help with?
Oh, it helps. It helps with actually paying for the hosting of the show and upgrading equipment. As I don't want to talk over this music. Folks, we'll give you our contact info right after the jump. May the Force be with you. Oh man, I felt bad, Bethany, because I don't feel good plugging our Patreon over John Williams. It just feels wrong. But no, actually, in all seriousness,
well, I just thought haven't really explained like what the Patreon stuff is used for recently.
Most recently, the actual audio cables right now that I just installed today, we came from you guys supporting us. So when it comes to equipment upgrades and paying for hosting and all that kind of other costs that need to be covered. We really appreciate everyone who's supporting us directly at patreon.com/StarWarsReport. We encourage you to join us there. And if you can't toss in a few coins, that's okay. We definitely appreciate anyone who can support us by getting the word out via iTunes. That really helps if you leave us a rating and review there. So by all means, head to StarWarsReport.com/iTunes, and that's a great way to support us directly. Also, I felt bad because we don't have time to get to feedback, but I do have it in the docs. We've got some voicemails, some emails, so shoot them our way. We definitely want to hear from you guys on what you think about the film. So email us, StarWarsReport@gmail.com. If you want to record an MP3, you can attach that. We can play it on the podcast right here. I think that's about it, folks. You can find us on social media. Mark's at IllogicalRogue2, Bethany's at Bethany L. Blanton, and I am at The Riley Guy. That's all for this week's episode. We'll catch you guys next week talking about, you would be surprised, The Force Awakens. Folks, we'll see you on the other side. May the Force be with you. And remember, many Bothans died to bring you this podcast.